You are listening to the Cycling Podcast Féminin, proudly supported by Lloyds. Lloyds is supporting British cycling as a major sponsor and partner, having signed a multi-year deal in 2024. One of the flagship events is the Lloyds Tour of Britain Women, of course, which was held over 4 days in June this year. And next year's event will expand to a 5-day stage race. It will be held in August from the 19th to the 23rd, and it will be held that much closer to the Lloyds Tour of Britain Men, which makes a fantastic late summer of cycling in the UK, with the world's best women and men racing on British roads. Before all of that, Lloyds is also sponsoring the National Track Series and the National Trophy Cyclocross, and then the best in the country in those two disciplines will take part in the National Championship, sponsored by Lloyds, in the new year. And before we know it, we'll be back into a new road race season with the Lloyds National Series for Women kicking off in March and the Lloyds National Championships to be held in Wales next June. Lloyds, there at every stage. Now, let's join Rose and Co for this month's episode of the Cycling Podcast Féminin.
You're listening to the Cycling Podcast Féminin.
Well, hello and welcome to the Cycling Podcast Féminin. We are back. It's a bit of a back-to-school vibe, isn't it, after our prolonged break post-Tour de France fam. Thank you for joining us again, listeners. And I'm going along the back-to-school vibe. I'm glad to say that I'm joined by my two best students, that being Denny Gray. Hello, Denny. Denny laughing
hello.
At the idea of being the
what
best
is
student.
What's the lesson today, Rose?
Oh, gosh, we've got everything. That's going to ruin the rest of my intro, Denny, if I go into that now. I should introduce my other fantastic student. I'll let you fight it out amongst yourselves about who is the valedictorian of this class. And that's Rebecca Charlton. Hello, Rebecca.
Hello, Rose. I'm wearing, I've just realised as you've done that intro, a jumper very similar to the one that I wore to school, actually.
Oh, really? I mean, you're wearing like a khaki hoodie. Is that what school
we were
is
very?
That?
I was saying this the other day. We were very relaxed at our school.
My
friendship group. We just kind of wore sweatshirts. I think we were supposed to wear a blazer, but the moral of the story is we didn't. So I appreciate you saying I'm top of the class because that perhaps wasn't the case with my uniform choice at the time.
Well, I was going to wonder actually. I was wondering about how you were as students actually, Denny. I feel like you were sort of always kind of smoking behind the shed in the band, playing in the band. Did
wow.
you not? Were you just a very
no,
good student?
No, I wasn't that cool. I was fairly hard. I think I just coasted, basically. I was a through the middle kind of guy, you know. I wasn't head prefect, but I wasn't one of the ones that was picked out by the headmaster for being a cheeky chappy either.
A cheeky chappy?
Yeah.
That's the education terminology. Becca, how were you at school?
Well, I didn't wear my blazer, so let's just leave it there.
It's surprising that you actually, you know, went to school. Maybe you were just you weren't wearing your blazer and you were just hanging around the shopping market. And we won't go into, I won't question you guys anymore, seeing as I was a total swat. So I'll leave that there. But yes, we have, I say back to school vibes because we kind of have so many different interesting issues that have cropped up since the Tour de France fam, haven't there? Been some really intriguing storylines. There's been a lot of buzz around the weight of Pauline Ferrand-Prévot, the winner of the Tour de France fam. Lots of voices from all sides about that and about what does that mean for the other riders? What does that mean for the future of women's cycling? There have, of course, been at the Tour de Romandie. There were a number of teams disqualified for not offering up a rider to have a GPS tracker put on by the UCI. So we're going to be delving into that issue. Of course, looking ahead, this can be geography, and that's looking ahead to the Rwandan World Championships. Let's say the weight thing is biology, and let's say that the GPS tracker thing is technology. There you go. There's your lesson
today.
Oh,
my goodness.
Today,
I love it.
Children. We'll kind of be really delving into that. We will be touching on, and I think we'll do that first, touching on a bit about the racing, although it hasn't been, if we're totally honest, it hasn't been the most thrilling, has it? I'm looking at you, Simac Ladies Tour. Although Becca, as the commentator of the Simac Ladies Tour, I'm sure you will beg to differ, won't you?
You know, you knew that I was going to interject there. I loved the Simac Ladies Tour. But yeah, I had the pleasure of being lead commentator on that. And I think we obviously knew that Lavinia Vibas was going to win quite a few stages. But I just would like to say, actually, that the way she won was so impressive. Because, of course, every other team came in and said, we've got to find a way to shake Vibas before the finish line, understandably. But the way she rode, not only were the team brilliant, but her, as an individual rider, she was shutting things down herself. She was just like dancing through these stages going, okay, bring it on. Like, I'll close that down. I'll shut that move down. I'll do it myself. The team are here at points they're not, so I'm going to make a different move here and make sure that I don't make any mistakes. And she just rode it perfectly. And I think...
Not quite perfectly, Rebecca, because...
What, because she didn't win
she
the
only won
trial.
Five of six stages, didn't she?
I don't know if you were going to say that.
If she'd done it perfectly... Yeah, but
her time trial was staggering, Rose. it really was really impressive. But no, I think the fact that she had the ability to do it herself, and then her and the team forcing so many splits in the crosswinds that every time you were like, oh, if a break goes in these windy conditions and Rena Vibas is caught on the wrong side of it, it could be a really interesting narrative for the day. But it was Rena Vibas and her team.
Yeah.
Who were like up the road, job done for the rest of the day, and then finishing it off from a reduced group. So, yeah, I just thought she added to how impressive she's been all year at her all-round ability, not just being able to have that pure punch of power in the sprint, but the attentiveness that she's brought to the racing this season. Yeah, I just think she's brilliant.
But, I mean, we can't really... I mean, you know how to sell it, Rebecca, for sure. You would be in the Young Enterprise club at school, no doubt, knowing how to sell this race, which was kind of basically all sprints, and then one time trial, which was won by Zoe Backstead. But for me, it very much leaves me a bit cold, a race which really is all out and out sprint. I know sometimes we used to level that kind of insult at the women's tour, but in reality, the women's tour has always had a little bit more going on, or maybe, you know, maybe more like Ride London always being a sprint in the end. Doesn't really get me going, it has to be said. And to have had we've had a few women's tour races, haven't we, since the Tour de France fam. We've had Plouay, of course, which was won by Misha Bredevold for the third time in a row, which is, you know, quite an achievement in itself. The Tour de Romandie was the first of the World Tour races after the Tour de France fan, which actually was actually pretty thrilling. Elise Chabet winning it on the final day, the overall classification, and, turning round an 8-second deficit to Urshka Zygaard in doing so. And we've had, yeah, the Simac Ladies Tour. We should, of course, have the Tour of Scandinavia. We found out right at the beginning of the year that was not returning. It wasn't held last year, and it was hoped that it would return to the calendar at the end of August this year. But yeah, that is now the organising company has been liquidated. That is not coming back, which is a shame, because that was meant at some point to become one of the kind of great grand tours. Denny, what's your kind of feeling about, even though Rebecca has sold it so beautifully, about the Simac Ladies Tour?
Yeah, I mean, I think the racing generally at the World Tour level, at least, has been a little bit anticlimactic since the Tour de France Femme. Maybe I'm biased because, of course, we were there on the ground at the Tour de France Femme,
stuffing ourselves with cheese. That also helps your mood, doesn't it?
That does, yes. I have been having terrible withdrawal symptoms from French cheese ever since. But the racing has felt, well, it's been physically flat and flat in terms of the excitement levels, I think. And although Lorena Vibas's, you know, performances are incredibly impressive, and I think with the Simac Tour, you know, it's not always just about the parkour. It is about the teams and the way they ride them. And unfortunately, this time around, we just had a rider who's continues to be at the top of her game, and no one else can get close. And I don't think we should dismiss the idea of having flat races, because it's important. I enjoy seeing sprinters go head to head. And, you know, if we had two or three sprinters that were of similar quality, we could have some fantastic finishes. You know, think back to the last year in the Tour de France, when we had Charlotte Accoul and Lorena Vivas going head to head, and a great rivalry there. But what we're missing is the rivalry, not the... So I don't think it's all about the parkour. But yeah, it has felt a bit of a disappointment. And I think, well, it relates to the Tour of Scandinavia point, really. I think, you know, putting on World Tour races is not easy in this day and age. Putting together the sponsors, getting the broadcasters interested, is still a challenge, unfortunately. So we can't just pick and choose where we want races. Even the stages we want, we can't pick and choose. But I do want to come back to Lorena Vivas, because she's won 24 races this year. And we were all saying perhaps SD Works wouldn't be as dominant this year, but they've won, I think it's 46 races now. And the second team in the most winningest team list is UAE, ADQ, and they've won 24 races too. So the same as Lorena Vivas. So Lorena Vivas in herself is winning more races than all the other teams put together. So yeah, incredibly impressive, and we should continue to doff our hat to her.
Yeah, well, she's gonna, you know, we can't see any stopping, can we, really, to her winning. Because I mean, Becca, before our call, actually, you said what was interesting about the CIMAC Ladies Tour was the fact that the teams were trying to do all sorts of different things to try and not bring it down to a sprint, which is incredibly difficult when it is so flat like that.
Yeah, completely. Because as you say, you know, we've seen people saying, right, well, we'll try and lose her on an incline if there's a big climb on the course. Of course, they didn't have that. So then people were like, we'll force it in the echelons. But she's just too strong. You just couldn't get rid of her. And I think that was really the biggest talking point. And back to your point there, Denny, I feel sometimes, even myself, that I do, even with my level of enthusiasm about how the race was won, but sometimes I don't talk enough about how good she is, because it's like, yeah, well, Weavers is going to win and she won. But actually, the way she's winning is evolving and is improving the whole time. But yeah, I thought, like, Visma Lisa bike at CIMAC, they did a perfect lead out on the last stage of the race. But again, she was just too strong. But they really did take it to her. And then she just interrupted their train. She's like, right, well, I'll just hop in here. So it was interesting from that point of view. But yeah, like Denny says, we need that rivalry to all level up for it to be, yeah, the pinnacle of sprinting that we all want.
Yeah, I mean, it's fair to say, isn't it, the next kind of big target is the World Championships, which are in Rwanda this year. We'll be talking nearer the end of the episode more about that, giving a preview of what we can expect there. But we should talk actually about the Tour de Romandie, because the big talking point there was actually happened before the racing had even begun, didn't it, on that first stage. The Tour de Romandie Women's World Tour race, it was starting with a time trial. And five teams were disqualified before starting. Those were Visma Lisa Bike, Canyon SRAM, EF Education Oatly, Picnic PostNL, and Lidl Trek. That is because the UCI bringing in part of their SAFER project, which is something they're kind of rolling out this year in light of the fact that the tragedy of Muriel Fuhrer, the junior racer who died at the World Championships last year in Switzerland. The emergency services couldn't find her after she crashed off the course. So the UCI bringing in this GPS tracking system. They want to track all of the riders in order to know their location. They're putting it across all bikes when it comes to the World Championships, and they were trialling it at the Tour de Romandie. They were asking for one rider from each team to be the guinea pig for that, to have this GPS tracker fitted to their bike. These five teams objected to, not to the GPS system, not to the safety protocols, but objected to choosing a rider as they thought that that rider would be at a disadvantage. The UCI then refused to choose one of their riders to have this GPS tracker fitted, and so they were all disqualified. It's a really intriguing story, isn't it, Denny? Because there's so many kind of stakeholders involved in this sport, and this is kind of an example of where it doesn't all quite work, because, you know, the teams are protective over the riders, they're protective over their bikes. The UCI obviously have control, but, you know, the UCI are not race organisers outside of the World Championships. So, yeah, this is kind of one of those times when all of these different stakeholders means that everything kind of grinds to a halt to an extent.
Yeah, I mean, you said earlier that you felt this is the technology lesson, but
yes,
actually I think it's more politics.
Yeah.
Oh. In many ways, because on the face of it, it feels a bit nonsensical. You try and scratch your head and work out why did it come to this, that five of the biggest teams in the world were disqualified from this race over something so minor, really, which was basically a disagreement about who would choose a rider to put a GPS tracker onto their bike. And yet there we were. And it does feel like, I mean, I read an interview or a piece by Kayleigh Fretz on the Escape Collective. He'd spoken to Jonathan Wouters, of course, at EF Education, and he described it as a kind of straw that broke the camel's back incident. And clearly this is as much about power struggles and about the way the teams feel the UCI is or isn't working with them, is or isn't collaborating with them, whether they need consent. There's a bigger debate over rider data, because of course those that own the rider data may be able to generate income from that in the future, and of course there aren't many ways to generate income in cycling. So it's unfortunately, this was something aimed at improving rider safety, which I think everybody wants, whether that's the UCI, the teams, the riders, the fans, but the stakeholders themselves just couldn't agree. And I think it just highlights this kind of fracture in women's cycling and cycling more generally between the UCI and the teams. So yeah, I feel like it's more of a governance and political issue than it is really about the technology itself.
I mean, that's the kind of interesting thing, isn't it, that one thing that you could say also is like, is how much value safety wise is there on putting this technology on a bike? I mean, at the end of the day, how much is that protecting the rider and knowing the location of the rider, and how much is that knowing the location of the bike or gaining data from the bike? And, you know, realistically, how can this be, you'd have to put this GPS tracker on every bike, you know, the riders swap bikes during the race, that, you know, if there's a mechanical, they need to get a bike from the car. Does that mean that there is a GPS tracker on every single bike? I mean, also what is interesting is that these teams are all affiliated with Velon. Velon is obviously much more active in the men's side of the sport. But yes, these teams are all affiliated with it. They are also developing their own GPS tracker. So from some quarters, some people could say, you know, are they making these objections to the UCI, putting on these GPS trackers, because that's effectively seeding the power and potentially the commercial value to the UCI when Velon have got something similar in the pipeline themselves. I mean, Becca, what's your sort of take on it? Because, you know, as Denny says, we obviously all want the riders to be safe. You know, is this the best way of doing it? You know, should the teams be behind it if there's any value in gain, you know, benefiting safety in any way, should they be behind it regardless?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And I think that you've both touched upon so many of the nuances to it, really, because I think when I so many people would have been in the boat that I was in that when you first saw the big debate happening around it. And of course, I don't think anyone thought that number of teams wouldn't line up. I think we just thought, well, that seems so extreme. And it was only when I started looking into the reasons behind it and the opinions from DS's live authors explaining actually, right, these are a lot of things no one's considering in this conversation. I think it was only when I started to really understand it, because at first it just seemed a lot more black and white, didn't it? It was like, okay, so the UCI are addressing safety, and that's a really good thing because we want the riders ultimately, after such a terrible, terrible tragedy, we do not want to disregard rider safety. So then why are the teams saying we're rejecting this safety feature or this development to make the riders safer? But of course, that, when we delved into it, wasn't the case. It wasn't black and white, was it? As you say, the more you dive into it, the more you find out. The teams that ultimately were disqualified and didn't start were huge teams. They were, you know, arguably the biggest teams in the peloton. They were using their voices more than the smaller teams. They were teams that were largely affiliated with Velon. Was there a commercial, as you say, was there a commercial question there about diminishing the commercial value that they might have with that affiliation with Velon, who are also developing the GPS side of things? So I just found that I can't answer the question as to whether the process is the right one, whether it is going to lead to the improvement in safety that everybody wants. I don't think anyone's debating that side of it, are they? Whether or not we should be looking at rider safety. It was evidently how it was done. And the UCI was saying that the teams were communicated with in good time. Obviously, there's been a lot of teams saying that that wasn't the case. And it seemed to me very much from the outside that it did seem very last minute in terms of riders literally on a start line and being told, right, you're not racing. I mean, when did those and I don't know all the answers to this. When did those conversations start taking place? Did you guys feel like it all happened very last minute and it was perhaps one of those occasions that's been highlighted before where it's been the UCI saying, right, here's a new rule, or here's what we've, like, I'm trying to pick the right word here, I don't know if impose is the right word, but here's what's going to happen, and then teams react and there's not enough time for that conversation to play out. Ultimately, that seemed to be the case with Romandy, in that those teams just got turned away because the conversations didn't have time to take place.
Yeah, I always feel like these UCI things suddenly come in, but I think that's partly because, you know, I'm not a DS.
We don't know.
A general manager. Yeah, I'm not having these constant communiques about these different rule changes and these different steps and all of the different steps in the project. And actually, the UCI make rules and change rules all the time, but not necessarily all of them capture any kind of newsworthy attention. And you know, how much news would have been made of it if they had all just said, yep, we've selected this rider and let's get on with it. Then we wouldn't have been probably hardly even worth any of us talking about the issue, because, you know, the teams would have just gone along with it. It would have been interesting because, on the face of it, the teams were objecting to having to select a rider to have this GPS tracker on. That's how this all happened. So it would have, and it's kind of like a 60-gram tracker that goes on the bike. I mean, the teams were saying they didn't want to select someone because it would be a disadvantage to them against everyone else in the peloton to have had this GPS tracker on. They also didn't want to, the teams didn't want to have any responsibility for, you know, any potential damage to the bikes, any injuries to the riders that could come up because of this, having this additional GPS tracker on the bike. They didn't want to kind of take any responsibility. So it would be interesting, had the UCI said, right, it's a blanket, everyone is having it, like they will at the World Championships, but of course at the World Championships the riders will be representing their countries, they won't be representing their trade teams, so the argument isn't, you know, really there to be had. It would have been interesting, what would those teams have done? Would they have refused to have any of their riders have the GPS tracker. You know, how would they have negotiated around it if the UCI said everyone is having it here at the Tour de Romandie, as opposed to what it was, which was, you know, the team's not selecting a rider for the GPS tracker, the UCI also not selecting a team, not selecting a rider per team. You know, how would that have all played out? It's an intriguing... well, I guess we will find out, won't we? We'll find out how it plays out, because, you know, the understanding is the UCI will want to roll this out, you know, more widespread in the forthcoming season. So these are all debates and arguments that will have to be had between now and next year. Well, shall we move... You've both passed, by the way. You both passed your politics... class.
Can I just throw in a question? This one's, I'm going to throw this to you, Denny. One thing that did get me thinking, just before we move off the, what was it, tech or politics lesson, because the biggest talking point seemed to be that, as you just said, Rose, the UCI weren't going to select the rider, and that was an issue for the teams, of that not being a fair process. But if they'd been told, right, we're going to put it on your GC leader, for example, and taken the choice away, would that have been any better? Denny, please answer my question. Better or worse?
Well, the teams would argue that, well, from what they've said, which is basically, yeah, they disagreed because they wanted the UCI to choose the rider and therefore to take on any liability, kind of the way it was installed. They say they would have accepted it. And the teams have also pointed out that there was a trial at the Tour de Suisse, which is in the entire men's and women's peloton, that was done across the entire peloton. And it was done with the consent and the collaboration of everybody, including the teams, and it went ahead. And that was done through a project outside of the UCI. And that's, so again, this does feel like an exercise in brinkmanship, and both this is about the teams trying to, you know, just trying to show the UCI who's boss and vice versa. And unfortunately, although the racing was actually quite exciting in the end, but I do feel sorry for the organisers here who have put on a race and they're left with 60 riders and none of the, you know, arguably the top five teams in the world not participating. So, yeah, it's unfortunate that the UCI and the teams couldn't have talked about this earlier and tried to reach some compromise.
Yeah, and just my last point on it, and of course the riders, with this being such an important point in the season for riders that haven't done what they want to do yet, it took a lot of opportunity away from people. So yeah, ultimately I think that was kind of my conclusion on it, that the debate overshadowed the issue at the core of it, which is everybody wants a safer sport.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton. Cycling Podcast Team Car at the back of the pack, please.
That's Seb Piquet, the voice of Radio Tour, and this is Lionel here to tell you that this episode is sponsored by NordVPN, the fastest virtual private network in the world to keep all of your data safe and secure whenever you're online. Now, one NordVPN account can be used on up to 10 devices, so it can keep you safe and secure however you're connected to the internet, whether that's with your laptop, tablet or phone, or perhaps even your smart TV or your internet router at home. They can all be protected by NordVPN. And the most important benefit is that that will protect your private data, keep your bank details, passwords and online identity safe from anyone who might want to hijack it and use it for nefarious means. NordVPN threat protection also protects you from viruses, malicious malware and phishing websites. So if you receive one of those emails that looks like it's legitimate on the surface, but then on further inspection gives you a moment of doubt, NordVPN will step in and protect you and prevent anything bad happening if you accidentally click on something that's trying to pretend to be something that it isn't. There are other benefits too. NordVPN can switch your virtual location, which can help you to save money when purchasing things like flights and hotels. And when you're traveling outside of the country, you can change your region and carry on watching your favorite TV shows or sporting events too. NordVPN is affordable premium cybersecurity for the price of a cup of coffee a month. And as you're a Cycling Podcast listener, you can get the best discount off a NordVPN plan at nordvpn.com/TCP. Our link is in the show notes, and if you use that link, you'll get 4 months extra for free on top of a 2-year plan. There's no risk either with Nord's 30-day money-back guarantee. So go to nordvpn.com/tcp.
Let's talk about... let's move on to our next lesson tonight. I shouldn't say let's talk about... Like, you know, we're not all equals here. I am, of course, the teacher. I should be. And you unruly pupils should be put kept in your place. let's move on to talking about a huge debate that was ignited at the Tour de France FAM, wasn't it? And that was surrounding the weight of Pauline Ferrand-Prévot. She, of course, won the Tour de France FAM in quite phenomenal fashion, but her preparations for the Tour de France FAM, which she then eventually won, did involve her losing about 4 kilograms of weight between Paris-Roubaix, which is of course April, which she also won, and the Tour de France FAM. We did see her; she was cutting a very lean figure, but that obviously is not uncommon in cycling. Yeah, Rebecca, what's your take on it? Because obviously, well, we didn't have a comment from Pauline Ferrand-Prévot about being so thin, apart from her saying that it was all part of controlled, it was done intelligently, it was done with nutritionists and coaches, and she just hasn't got any intention of staying so light, because she doesn't think it's healthy to stay that light, but it's merely a kind of means to an end. But of course, because she won the race, we did have comments from several other riders who were then kind of cajoled into commenting about their own weight. Demi Vollering, of course, saying that, you know, it's important to her to show younger riders, to show young girls that you can compete in the high mountains without being, I think she said, without being super, super skinny. So that's what Vollering's kind of view was. Marlon Reusser also came out saying, you know, we kind of didn't want Pauline Ferrand-Prévot to win because she was so light. It kind of, maybe it sets a precedent that we don't want to go down. But yeah, but Rebecca, what's your kind of take on this? I know you'll have a strong opinion that it'll be very hard for us to... I have to say, Rebecca gave me such a great comment on WhatsApp yesterday, wasn't it, when we were kind of going through what we were going to talk about today. And Becca said, "That's great, thanks for giving me a heads up so I can start climbing up to the top of my fence to sit on my fence now."
You're going to be the kind of teacher that I dreaded at school that wouldn't let me sit on the fence and forced me to have an opinion. No, I have a few opinions about this topic, actually, and it is something that I have given quite a lot of thought to, as I think a lot of people in our sport, in any involvement in our sport, have had as well, because it is a really important one, and I'm really glad that we are talking about it and that the riders are responding in the way that they want to, which is tick in the box of social media, which isn't always positive, but it has allowed each rider, which I feel like every big rider went away from the tour and reflected on this topic and actually put a statement out there for young fans, for people to absorb what they thought about it. So I thought it was good in a lot of ways. But I mean, it's kind of going back to the point on our former topic about the GPS and the safety of our sport, is that I feel like this debate overshadowed in so many ways the win of Pauline Ferrand-Prévot of the Tour. I feel like it was a huge moment for her in her home country, and it was brilliant, and we wanted to celebrate that. And then it quickly turned into this conversation about weight. And then I just jotted down that Demi Vollering said that around 80% of the questions that she took in the press conference after the race, after the Tour, were about her weight, as a consequence of that conversation around how Pauline perhaps won the race. So that was my first point, really, is I think it was, although it's an important conversation, it overshadowed Pauline's win. And I don't think that was fair, that instead of saying to her, like, let's talk about how fantastic your win was in the biggest bike race in the world, after saying that you're going to come onto the road, and all those talking points that could have been there almost like didn't really happen because everybody was talking about the weight conversation. So I think that was a shame. But I do think the way she responded in putting out the information about how she did it and why she did it and the justification for doing it in a very measured way, and she said, didn't she, I'm not doing this every day of the year. I'm not keeping my weight long term at this level that I have essentially honed for the biggest target of my season. She's not going to do that for every single race. So I think the way she put the information out there so people could understand, I thought that was important. And she's obviously just such a big, big role model in our sport across the disciplines. So many people follow her lifestyle, the way she wins bike races, everything about her. So I thought it was, yeah, she took that responsibility on to say, this is how I've done it, why I've done it. And no, you shouldn't do this without a superb team of medical experts and nutrition experts and all this support team around you. You can't just say, right, I'm just going to, you know, strip X number of kilograms off my body weight and expect to not have any detrimental effects long term. And yeah, but my plan isn't to hold this weight long term. So I liked that she put that info out there. The fact that it then became, well, Demi Vollering, should you be losing weight? You know, it was just kind of descending into this conversation that it never should have become in my mind. But equally, we have to, we can't get away from the fact that we're in a power to weight ratio sport. And so when the high mountains come into play, we do end up not being able to avoid the fact that it comes down in part to body weight. And something else I thought was unfair is that I don't very often hear, I don't know about you, I don't hear many people talking about Jonas or Tade and their weight and whether they're setting a bad example for young boys. I don't hear that. But all that said, it is a dangerous place to be if we're saying to people, the only way you can do this is by losing weight. So I think, yeah, it goes back to the fact that the riders responded, they came out and they said what, you know, what they truly felt about the topic and the conversation. So yeah, Marlon Royce, as you mentioned earlier, very much candid, as we've come to expect from Moisa, which I love, that she'll just say it like it is in an interview. And yeah, she said something along the lines, didn't she, that we secretly hoped that Pauline wouldn't win, because then it set a precedent that everybody needed to look at losing more body weight, essentially improving their power to weight ratio. So yes, a topic that I could just go on and on and on with, because there is, it's not black and white. There isn't one answer. We should be having conversations about how the sport is healthier. We don't want people going away saying, well, I'm just going to skip meals because that's the way I'm going to win a bike race. And Vollering saying that she'll always put her health first. She'll put that before anything else, because that's all that matters is her health, but also being a healthy role model to others. So she,
this is Rebecca Charlton going for debating club champion, isn't it?
It's just because because it is so complex, isn't it? But it
feels like a filibuster.
Sorry, Tony.
It feels like a filibuster.
Shall I hand the debate baton over to Denny?
You seem to be debating a lot with yourself, which I don't think normally the debating champions do that. But
you could, well, just, that you way could she just speed could me up and stay
on
the fence
by being on both sides.
Yeah. I mean, it's difficult, isn't it? Because Pauline Ferrand-Prevot coming out and saying that it's all done healthily. That's fine, that's great, that's good for her, but obviously that doesn't, not everyone has access to a team of nutritionists and doctors. And so what does that mean for actually most of the peloton, or, you know, younger riders coming up? Does it set a dangerous precedent? Denny, what's your kind of view on it?
Yeah, I mean, I completely take Becca's point about the fact that the debate has overshadowed the racing somewhat since the Tour de France fam, but it is a really important debate. And I guess, to play devil's advocate, if no one had asked Pauline Ferrand-Prevot or Demi Vollering the questions about weight, we may be in a situation where a lot of riders may have noticed that Pauline Ferrand-Prevot had lost weight and just quietly gone away and thought, well, I've got to do that too, without any discussion. And I think it has generated some really valuable discussion, some not so helpful discussion too. But as you say, Rose, it's also elicited a lot of rider stories, kind of female pros sharing personal stories about disordered eating and recovery. Cedrine Cabal, who's a nutritionist herself, did a nutrition degree, kind of talking about the fact that obviously losing weight can have huge impacts on menstrual cycles and can cause long-term health damage. But I think the key thing is that when we have these kind of debates, we need to look at whether it leads to any systemic change. And I noticed that the Cyclists Alliance have actually called for kind of measures which will protect athlete well-being across the piece and not just the riders that can afford nutritionists and the top specialists around them. So they've called for mandatory health screenings around issues like relative energy deficiency in sport, or REDS as it's known for short, and bone density. They're calling for nutrition or kind of education programs on nutrition. So there is a campaign now to try to get the UCI and others to step in and to strengthen the system, because what is clear is that otherwise it is more difficult, especially for riders that don't have the resources and the advice and the access to the best advice to do well. And at the end of the day, as you said, Becca, this is, when it comes to mountains, you know, performance is partly about weight. It's not wholly about weight, but weight is an important factor, and we can't get away from that in cycling, unfortunately. So it is a really tricky balance.
It's really tricky. I was actually talking to Danny Rowe the other day about this, and it was the first time she's ever said to me how many years she went without a period during her professional cycling career, and it really shocked me that she had gone for the most part of her career without having a period. And she said that now that is very much a conversation happening in cycling teams. And so, yeah, it's a very good thing that we're talking about it. Cycling teams are putting importance on it. And she was saying that now within the fold of a team, if it becomes apparent that somebody is not having a period, that conversation now happens, which, you know, clearly didn't back in her career days.
Yeah, I mean, it is something that has been a long-term issue, though, hasn't it, in cycling? This isn't a new thing. I remember back when I started covering women's cycling, there's a fantastic champion, Mara Abbott, who's two-time Giro d'Italia, Giro Rosa champion, and she spoke very openly about riding, racing, even, with an eating disorder, with anorexia, and she was saying that it was all about control. And obviously in cycling, there, you know, we have this culture of marginal gains that doesn't exist really in all sports. Obviously people want to be on peak performance, but there's so many other factors in, you know, if you think about football, you know, you're trying to beat the opposition. It's not like you're trying to just get the very best, you know, the very most out of your body. So it is something that's going to crop up, because, you know, disordered eating is all about control. And Mara Abbott actually said that for her, she felt like she couldn't control her results, she couldn't control how well you know, her ranking was, you know, how quickly she finished in a race, but she could control her food. And it all became she became absorbed by having that control over what she was eating and what her intake was. And actually, in the end, you know, we talk a lot about power to weight ratio, but, you know, Mara Abbott was saying that she got to a point where she was getting weaker, she was getting less powerful, she didn't hatch because she wasn't fueling herself appropriately for the kind of exertions that she was making. Obviously, that is not at all what we're saying about Pauline Ferrand-Prevot. I mean, the fact that you know, we saw a fantastic performance, but she was very well fueled for nine stages and proved it by being out the front on that final stage, which wasn't, as much as it was a mountain stage, it wasn't like a mountain goat stage, was it? It was kind of bumpy and there were big plateaus and big flat bits. And obviously she wasn't starving herself. She wasn't restricting herself in order to do that and to achieve that. But I think it is also something that was going to happen, wasn't it, in women's cycling? Because for years we've had a calendar where the top classics riders and top one-day riders in those kind of cobbled classics in Belgium were also the people who were winning the Giro and you know, now winning the Tour de France. We're now seeing that specialisation in women's cycling, which we haven't seen before. So I think it's interesting that this conversation has come up now, because we've got this... a point where we are reliably having these huge alpine passes, these very long, 10-kilometer, 15-kilometer, 18-kilometer long climbs, which we didn't used to have. So now riders can be more specialised towards that. They can use, and part of their racing schedule is to lose weight to be stronger in those mountains, which we didn't used to have. We didn't, you know, we occasionally have a big alpine pass or a big mountain in the Giro, but that wasn't always there. So, you know, riders were much more kind of a different build, ready for the classic season that might kind of continue on. So, yeah, it's an interesting time, I think, to be having this conversation just at that tipping point now, where there's also a lot more on the line for the women's peloton than there used to be. You know, there's a lot more money, there's bigger contracts, there's more opportunity, there's kind of bigger prizes on offer. So I do think it's important that it's part of the conversation now.
Yeah, absolutely. And it, you know, and rider health goes beyond weight, of course. And it, and I think we this is a sport, as you kind of alluded to earlier, Rose, where it's often down to the individual to decide what risks they take. And that's why I think it's really important that we, you know, look as a sport to get systemic change, so that it's not just down to individual choice about the weight they take, the supplements they take, the kind of risks they take in trying to be the best and make those marginal gains. There are certain procedures in place to check on rider health, give riders the access to the information they need, and so on, and that, you know, that obviously needs to happen, as you say, as we move forward.
I think that's also the thing, is that, you know, a lot of athletes, particularly cyclists, they aren't healthy. You know, they aren't healthy. What they're trying to achieve is not to be the most healthy body. I mean, the reason that we kind of are so in awe of them is that they do things that seem sort of beyond our capabilities. Is just not to say that we're all average Joes here, of course, but you know that they are doing extreme things and their body goes through extreme things to try and achieve that. I think it's kind of wrong to hold them up necessarily. I think role models are really important, and being a role model for being strong and persevering, for having grit, for having determination, you know, I think those are all really important values, but I think it's incorrect to kind of hold, you know, cyclists up as role models for being kind of for being healthy, because, you know, what they put their bodies through isn't normal and isn't healthy. And, you know, all the things they do in order to achieve that aren't healthy things and shouldn't be held up as ideals of health to young people. You know, there's lots of other ways in which they are great, phenomenal role models. But, you know, I think in health ways, perhaps not. One of us mentioned earlier that some of the debates around this are useful and some of them are not useful. So I can only hope that our particular debate on this podcast right now was one of the useful ones. But it does feel like a topic that needed to be mentioned.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Shall we look ahead? Shall we look ahead to the World Championships, which I actually can't believe are already on our doorstep. I can't believe also that these Rwandan World Championships, the first World Champs to be held in Africa, are on our doorstep. Because I remember when that was first mentioned by the UCI, first announced, and that feeling like a really distant thing, a really unusual thing. But you know, here we are. They're going to be taking part in, well, as we record, in a couple of weeks time. Becca, what can we expect from this World Championships?
3,350 meters of elevation.
She's got her notebooks with her. Somebody brought their textbooks with them today.
Well, I've just been jotting away since you said, you know, essentially we're in class now. And of course I want to beat Denny. So I've bought my accurate gauge of the elevation gain of the women's road race. 164.6 kilometres. 3,350 metres of climbing. But essentially it's not flat. It's no Simac Ladies Tour.
I see you've got your compass, your pair of compasses and your protractor out there, Becca. I was just doing a bit of trigonometry here to try and work it out for you guys.
It was just so annoying every time I used to put my hand into my pencil case and prod myself with the protractor. That was the sharp one, right?
No, not the protractor. The pair of compasses is the sharp one. Oh no.
Oh no, I've fallen at the last hurdle.
How did you get
hurdle?
On with your maths GCSE, by the way?
Oh my gosh, let's edit that out. I definitely
the protractor's the semicircle one, Becca.
Oh my god. This is embarrassing.
So they're definitely the protractor's sharp one. I remember we on a trip to Le Vendée in at secondary school, we had a competition at the back of the coach to see who could drop the point of the protractor onto their thigh from the highest distance.
Oh my god.
Hang on,
did you go to a boys' school
or a compass?
Chance,
I'm so confused now.
And what was the highest? Who got it? And who? What was the highest?
I don't recall the actual height, but I do remember being in a lot of pain afterwards and having kind of these little round pocked marks in my thigh for several days afterwards.
Well, I'm so glad that you didn't bring that back on our little French road trip.
Well, maybe if we get bored at the back of a team bus one day, we can bring a protractor with us.
We can, well, we put that out to the listeners, the worst thing that someone's ever done with a pair of compasses.
Yes, compasses even. I've got an even now.
No, you're getting confused. No, I'm starting to question
you, Denny.
Myself.
Back in the running.
Yeah. Anyway, Becca, you now have the right math set with you at least, so you can tell us more about this this road race.
So I also jotted down that Rwanda is known as the land of a thousand hills, so I definitely wouldn't ride my bike there. But yeah, if I haven't made it obvious, it is a little bit climby, which I do think is very interesting. Of course, the first thing to say in terms of who's fielding the race, we're not gonna have Lotte Kopecky defending her bands, which I know that we are all sad about, but it's not really a surprise, is it? Because she'd been very vocal throughout the season that she wasn't in the place she wanted to be injury wise and the form wasn't there for her as a result. So yeah, no surprises that Kopecky won't defend. It does mean we'll have a new champion in the rainbow bands this year. And yeah, I think I speak for everyone when I say we're really disappointed, but of course it's the right decision for her. She did confirm that she has a fractured vertebrae after the most recent crash, and that's to add to a list of difficulties, isn't it, that she's had this season. So I'll be so disappointed not to see her racing, because I love watching her race, especially at the level of the World Championships. She's such a joy, isn't she? But the right decision. For obvious reasons that she's not going to be racing. But yeah, I've just been having a little look down the start list. Of course, we at this point, normally when we record our pod, we don't know exactly, do we, who's definitely racing.
Normally it's just Marlon Reusser, isn't it?
Yeah, just, I mean, she is confirmed. So yet again. And one rider we do know will be there is Pauline Ferrand-Prevot, going the opposite way, saying that she definitely wasn't going to be fielding it, and now she's changed her calendar and she will be, which I'm very excited about. It'll be really interesting to see, won't it? Because as we've talked a lot about, she said the Tour de France for Mavic Swift is just my absolute peak for this season. So I mean, you can only imagine she's going to come in brilliant form to the Worlds. And yeah, I'm really excited to see it. And in terms of, at the moment, looking at that preliminary start list, she's got a good team around her as well. Really interesting team from France. My other thing that I was thinking in looking at the Dutch team is, I feel like for the first time in a long time, it's quite clear who's going to come in as the leader there. Because in previous years, because of the nature of the course, we've said, well, who are they going to prioritise? Are we going to see too many cooks in the kitchen? And that has been evident. And they have lost the Worlds before as a squad because of that. But this year, I would say it is quite clear that it's going to be Vollering leading the team. And yeah, for that reason that it's quite hilly, I think the squad could be stronger for it.
Yeah, it's kind of, it's in Kigali, isn't it? The capital city of Rwanda. It's kind of like a local circuit with two major climbs on it. They're going around 11 times. I say major climbs, they're kind of punchy climbs. The riders will be kind of racing around the local circuit 11 times. There's a cobbled climb, which I like that. The Kimihurura, hold on. The Côte de Kimihurura is a cobble climb, and also the Côte de Kigali Golf, which I believe is actually next to a golf course, as opposed to like the Gulf of Morbihan. When me and Denny arrived at the Tour de France Femme, I was saying, we've got a golf hotel for this, you know, first few nights, Denny, and I'm picturing, you know, like any golf hotel, view over kind of nine holes, spa, all of that, delightful, expensive restaurant. That's what I was picturing. And then we obviously turn up in like what was effectively like a campanile, wasn't it? But it was next to the Gulf of Morbihan, like the, as in the body of water. That is a gulf.
Maybe the teacher needs to go on a languages lesson.
Yes, no doubt. But yes, this Kigali Golf climb is next to a golf course. Hopefully they have a lovely luxurious hotel there. But it's really intriguing, isn't it? Because the riders will not, by and large, will not have had much experience. Well, the European riders anyway, it should be said, won't have much experience of riding in Africa at all. I mean, there is only, on the men's side, there is the Tour de Rwanda, which is obviously quite is very established race. It's been running for many, it's been running for decades, actually. And it's quite an established race. People kind of have it as one of their races that they kind of liked to go to, even quite major riders. But we don't have that on the women's side. I mean, there is only one UCI race in Africa, and that's a 2.2 this year. That was the Pupkewitz Megabuild Windhoek Women's Tour in Namibia, and kind of fielded almost entirely by African teams and African riders. So it'll be a really interesting experience, I think, particularly for the women's peloton, more than the men's, to be going out and riding there. And it's kind of, I also think, what a fantastic time to be doing it, bearing in mind the fact that we had such an outstanding performance from Kim LeCourt at the Tour de France Femme, you know, who kind of broke down so many barriers this year for African cycling. So it's kind of a perfect time to be going to Rwanda. That being said, obviously, it kind of, we shouldn't forget that at the beginning of the year, this looked really like it was unlikely to happen, bearing in mind the conflict that's going on the borders between Rwanda and the DRC by the M23 rebel group. They obviously have come to some agreement for now, which kind of allows this World Championships to go on. But certainly, you know, the Rwanda has been accused of kind of sports washing, hasn't it, all year. I mean, we see that they kind of have a lot of sponsorship of football teams about Visit Rwanda, and obviously hosting this World Championships. Again, like from a political point of view, there was lots of questions raised about whether they should be allowed to host this championships. But now that it is happening, it does come at a great time for African cycling, doesn't it, Denny?
Yeah, it does. And it feels like, I guess strategically, no matter what you think of the choice of Rwanda and how controversial you think that country is as a place to hold the World Championships, it's come at a time when it feels like the growth of African cycling has kind of halted a bit. There was a kind of wave of African riders that came or kind of appeared in the peloton, including on the men's side, and we had the Quebeca project, of course, and so on. But it feels like that wave has kind of fallen down, to pick a terrible phrase to describe how a wave behaves, but it's kind of rescinded a little bit. And so this, you know, I guess the hope is that this kind of kickstarts cycling and a focus on African cycling again. As you say, it will be a massive challenge for a lot of the European teams because it is quite a high level. It's Kigali's, I think, over 1500 meters above sea level in itself. So a lot of teams are thinking about how they prepare, you know, whether they go over early, 2 or 3 weeks early, to try and acclimate. The crowds will be phenomenally large based on the experience we've had with the Tour of Rwanda, and it will be a completely different kind of cultural experience for a lot of teams and riders. So it will be a huge event for Rwanda. I think you mentioned this off air, Rose, but a lot of teams, of course, have, because of the costs involved going there, have decided to field smaller teams. So the Netherlands isn't sending a junior or under 23 team, from what I understand. The USA said they're sending a smaller team. So it will be not a kind of full lineup of the world's best across all of the tiers.
It should be said, though, that also happened when they went to Australia. That isn't just specific to an African race, but any race that's sort of outside of Europe effectively sometimes has that treatment.
Yeah, it's I guess the justification is more that the costs aren't justified in terms of, you know, developing a rider if you're a junior or an under 23. But of course, we know from the past that, you know, a winner at a junior world road race or a good performance there can lead to contracts. So, you know, for some riders, that will mean they won't have that opportunity. But yeah, it's going to be, I mean, people are, and there's a lot of hype around it as well, isn't there? Just because of, as Becca said, an enormous amount of climbing. People are comparing it to the 1995 World Championships in Colombia, which was...
You remember that very well, of course, Denny.
Of course, but... of course. Well, I should remember it. I'm old enough to remember it, in theory, but I didn't watch it at the time. But that was a similarly, you know, tough parkour from what I've been reading, just because of the altitude and the meters climbed. I think in the women's race, Jenny Longo won, which is probably no surprise to anybody at the time, but she did crash at the beginning and had a massive gash in her leg and still won that race. But hopefully we won't be seeing any similar crashes, but hopefully we'll see some heroic performances on the road nonetheless.
Well, we should say, actually, this is the first time that we're also going to have an women's under 23 race, isn't it, as a separate race. Although, as you mentioned, Denny, you know, how well fielded that will be kind of remains to be seen. Obviously, France, again, I mean, France have an incredibly strong team in the elite competition, the likes of Cedrine Kerbal, Maeva Squiban, Vita Muzik, Juliette Labousse, all supporting Pauline Ferrand-Prevot, or, you know, depends who goes for it there, but really strong field. But they've even got a strong under-23 field as well. Marion Bunnell and Celia Jerry, Julie Bago. I mean, they're absolutely phenomenal riders. So they're obviously kind of going all in for that on the under 23 side. But Rebecca, what does it mean to have? And this isn't, necessarily a straightforward question, so I'm looking forward to one of your debating monologues. But, what does it mean to have an under-23 women's race? It's something, obviously, previously, the under-23 race has been decided on positioning in the elite race, which doesn't make sense in a team sport such as cycling, does it? Because, you might be the best domestique, in which case you'll be putting your rider in the best position and then you'll be out the back. But now we've got this solo under-23 race, which is fantastic. But there's not really going to be anywhere for the rider who wins the rainbow bands here to wear the rainbow bands, is there?
Oh, you've thrown a lot at me for my essay topic this week. I feel like I need to go away and come back to you on this. What does it mean to have an under-23 race? No, I do have an answer to it. I think that, we've wanted it for a long time, haven't we? And a lot of us have had a moan about the fact that, the under-23 winner had to come from the elite women's race. And the dynamic of that, for all the reasons that you've mentioned above, is massively affected by the nature of being a part of another race and that not being your priority to win it in the same way. I think that I'm going to waffle off at a tangent here. I was talking to Danny Christmas the other day. The DS for AG Insurance had out, and she was saying the importance of taking some of the younger riders to field races that they can try and tactically come up with an approach to win it rather than hanging in, getting experience, riding for others. Obviously, I mean, it sounds like such an obvious point, but when you're coming through the ranks of racing, it is so, so different mentally, physically, when you know you have a shot at going for that victory than if you're just riding it in a different way. So I think it's really good that we've got the race, whether or not it's going to be the best example of that this year, I can't promise that, but I think it's good that we have it, and the opportunities it presents are very different when it's a separate race.
Well, we've got lots to look forward to, more things to look forward to, don't we? More races to watch and enjoy that coming up on the horizon. Well, I was going to do an impression of a school bell. Does that sound like a school bell? Well, because that is school's out. You guys, Rebecca looks like she's about to have a nap. Is that what you did after school?
Rebecca, throw our papers up, haven't we?
Yeah. Jenny's thrown his notes up into the air. Yes, well done. Well, I think you both pass that, although maybe maths might be a fail.
Don't know the difference between a protractor and a compass.
Yeah, if I learn, look this up and find that I've been wrong the whole time. Well, that's typical of teachers, though, isn't it? If I have enough confidence, I'll get away with it. That's how it all works. But thank you both for joining me, and thank you, listeners, for getting back into the school spirit. So I'll leave you guys to, what was your kind of post school, what would you normally be doing after school, Becca? What was your normally your thing?
When I went home, I'd eat a bowl of bran flakes as a snack.
Oh,
there you go. That,
well, I think you look like you're about ready for that, actually, to go and sit and have your bran flakes.
And I've just looked up the AI overview of a protractor. It is a tool for measuring and drawing angles, typically made of a clear plastic and shaped like a semicircle or full circle. So there you go. You were right all along, Rose, and Denny and I were...
Of course she was.
Good. That A-star maths GCSE, still coming good, even now. Well, Denny, I'll let you get off to whatever you do after whatever you used to do.
Yeah, I've got to go and watch Gordon the Gopher and Philip Schofield on the BBC.
Oh, gosh. You've aged yourself horrendously there.
I have.
For me, it was always Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, The Simpsons. That was kind of like the double header post-school.
Neighbours.
Watching that.
What about Neighbours?
Not Neighbours. Neighbours. And Home and Away.
Neighbours, sorry. No, Neighbours first.
I was going to say, surely you're not... You didn't completely miss out on Neighbours being as young as you are.
No, I didn't. Sometimes we used to skive off and watch it, in sixth form anyway, used to skive off and watch it twice. So watch it in the daytime. and then watch it when you get home.
Here comes the truth. The truth comes out at the end of the podcast.
You find out. Find out. Yeah. Right. Well, thank you very much, both. And yes, shall I ring the school bell again?
Go on, one more time. I enjoyed it.
Thank you very much, listeners.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Burney.